First case this morning is case number 56674, Egan versus Chambers. Let me state for the record that Justice Pickering is around court business, but will be here later for the next argument, we hope. And Justice Sade is also away. And both will review this sort of argument and get an opportunity to conference on this later on. Ready to proceed? Go ahead.
Justices of the court, I'm here today asking the court and seeking redress from what I perceive to be the retroactive application of the Fiery versus Perez decision, which was issued and published in December of 2009. I'm sure the court's had an opportunity to review the briefs, but my client, Tammy Egan, who I expected to be here but apparently was caught in the elevator line, filed a suit in July of 2008 in a case that we couched in professional negligence. It was a matter seeking redress for injuries she sustained in the course of a podiatric surgery at the hands of defendant Chamber. Chambers, a licensed podiatrist. We filed, admittedly, the complaint without the benefit of an expert witness affidavit based on what I perceived to be the import of NRS 41A.071, which stated that, and still continues to state to this day, that a case for a medical malpractice or dental malpractice must be dismissed if it is not accompanied by the affidavit of an expert witness stating that he has reviewed the records and that he is satisfied that a breach of the standard of care has occurred. Now, the reason I filed without an affidavit is my reading of the express language of the statute was colored by the definitions contained in Chapter 41A. Medical malpractice was defined as a suit against a physician, hospital, or employee of a hospital. And that was 41A.09, I believe. And the statute further defined narrowed the definition of medical malpractice by defining a physician. And physician is defined by as a person licensed under Chapter 630 or Chapter 633 of the Nevada Revised Statutes. Dr. Chambers, as a podiatrist, is not licensed under either Chapter 630 or Chapter 633, whether he's a podiatrist and is licensed under another chapter, Chapter 635. So my reading of the express language of the statute indicated to me that this did not fall within the terms of a case of medical malpractice. Whether it would be professional negligence as defined in later sections of Chapter 41A. At the time that we filed, the Fiery decision was still 18 months away. The defense filed their answer and did not include an affirmative defense that this had failed to comply with the affidavit requirement contained in 41A.071. And in fact, the defense wasn't raised until after this court issued its decision in Fiery in December of 2009. As I read the Fiery decision, the court expanded the definition of medical malpractice or the application of the affidavit requirement to cases of professional negligence not involving the person statutorily defined as subject to medical malpractice allegations. I think I read the Fiery decision pretty thoroughly, it seems to me to extend the affidavit requirement to all of the healthcare providers listed in 41A.014, I believe. If memory serves me correct. But the problem, just as I see it, is in expanding the meaning of, or the persons subject to the affidavit requirement, the Firely decision rendered 41A.071 vague, as well as 41A.009 and 013. And I say that because the court in Firely stated on a number of occasions that when the voters passed the voter initiative in 2004, including this new statutorily defined cause of action for professional negligence, and applied a number of new protections to both of those persons defined as healthcare providers under 41A.014017, and to the existing physicians, it raised an ambiguity as to whether or not the legislature had intended to require the affidavit for persons not specifically defined as subject to the affidavit requirements by virtue of being in a medical malpractice or dental malpractice case. And looking at it, I would agree with the court's description of it as ambiguous, and I think that's important because when I looked up ambiguous in the dictionary just the other night, and the primary definition was that it was capable of more than one interpretation. A matter that is capable of more than one interpretation.
In this matter that's before the court, you talk in terms of the enactment of this law, and the action by the court is merely interpreting or clarifying the law that was enacted in 2004. So how do you deal with the issue that this is not new law, but it goes back to existing law?
Well, Judge, when the voters passed the initiative in 2004, the voters did not change the definition of medical malpractice or the definition of physician that had been in place since 2002. And in fact, those definitions had been in place since 1985 when we had the medical legal screening panel in place. Physician has always been described as a MDDO or persons licensed under the chapters regulating their licensure. And I mean, the answer to that is, well, the court itself stated that this was a matter of first impression, which I took to mean we're pronouncing new law. And in fact, the test that's set forth by Chevron Oil versus Hillsong incorporates that very factor in the three-part test, whether this is new law that should be applied prospectively only, or whether it is merely a clarification. The first factor is whether or not we should, the matter is a matter of first impression or a matter overruling existing precedent. The second factor is to what extent it was reasonable for the plaintiff to, or the party relying on the statute to rely on that, and through the hardship that would be visited upon the persons if retrospective application was given. Well, here we have a case where the court admittedly said, or expressly said, that this was a matter of first impression. Prior to this, prior to the Firely decision, we had the Baird matter, which, while not exactly on point, did state that in 1985, when the legislature singled out medical doctors and doctors of osteopathy for special protection in the medical legal screening panel, the legislature was justified in doing so because they may have perceived that those specific classes of persons are entitled to special protections. So when the 2004 amendments came in and did not modify the definition of medical malpractice or the definition or the definition of physician, who is a party statutorily subject to a matter of medical malpractice, I believe that the express language of the statute would have said that it's only that only physicians, hospitals, and employees of hospitals are subject to the affidavit requirement, and not other medical professionals. In saying that, I argued pretty extensively in the lower court, although I did not invoke due process in those terms, I did argue in the lower court that as it was written, the statute failed to give notice to people of ordinary intelligence that an affidavit would be required in order to file a professional negligence action against persons other than MDs or DOs, employees of a hospital.
Mr. Percival, did you ask the district court that if the district court disagreed with you on that point, based on the, I think we call it Fairley case, you should have leave to amend your complaint to be able to attach an affidavit because you didn't have notice of it based upon the statutory wording and the Fairley case was subsequent to your complaint being filed? Did you make that request to the district court?
I did not, Judge, because I had read Washoe Medical Center and some of the other cases where this court had said once, if the court determines that an affidavit was required and it's not supplied, then that matter is void ab initio and it cannot be cured by amendment. Now, what I did ask was that the court, because of the ambiguity in the statute and because the statute wasn't clear as to the requirement that a suit for professional negligence be accompany the complaint, that the court treat the statute limitations in the matter as having been told so that we could file not an amended complaint, because I was aware that a complaint that's void ab initio can't be amended. But we would have to, as I read Washoe Medical Center, in order to save the matter, we would have had to file with an affidavit in a completely new case. And I hope that I read that correctly, but that was my understanding of the import of Washoe Medical Center, is that we can't have an amendment that relates back. We would have to have an amendment, we would have to file a completely new case, and then hope that we're within the statute of limitations. Mm-hmm. Something I should point out, Judge, is that even though we filed this complaint in July of 2008, the motion to dismiss, we went through joint case conference, exchange of documents, the defendants had propounded written discovery on me, we had answered it, I had propounded written discovery. We went on for more than 18 months before the motion to dismiss was filed.
Did you have expert?
I had a letter in my hand from Dr. Barry Weiner, who's a podiatrist in Southern California, indicating that he had reviewed the medical records and describing for me why he felt that a case of negligence had occurred.
Do you remember approximately when you got that letter?
I do remember when I got that letter. I got it July 3rd of 2008. And I'm sure that what the court is wondering is why didn't I simply change that to affidavit form and then attach it to my complaint just out of an abundance of caution.
Read my mind.
Well, I could anticipate that that would be a question that someone would be interested in. Honestly, Judge, as I read the statute, I felt that it only applied to medical malpractice because it, first of all, 41.003 specifically says that the terms contained in this chapter are as defined in 41.003 through 41.014, and medical malpractice only applied to suits against physicians, defined as MDs or DOs, hospitals, and employees of hospitals. I did also consult with three, and I know that this isn't necessarily controlling, but I consulted with three other experienced medical malpractice professionals, all of whom shared the reading that I did. The point is of that is, if that is true, I mean, and I stand by that, I put it in my affidavit, and I'm telling you honestly that that is the truth. There certainly is reason to believe that this statute is open to more than one interpretation and doesn't give adequate notice to persons who read it, who read it before the issuance of the Fearley decision. It doesn't give notice to them that a professional negligence complaint would require the attachment of an affidavit, and that's why I didn't. I did have it in my hand, and in fact, by the time the motion to dismiss had been filed, we had already done our expert witness disclosure, and I had provided opposing counsel with a copy of that letter that I had received from Dr. Weiner. But it was, admittedly, it was not attached to the complaint.
Your time's up. Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. Wallman.
Thank you. No matter how many times I do this, when I stand before you, it's an awesome sight. I mean that word not in the vernacular, in the true meaning of that word. This case, I have to say I was surprised when it was scheduled for argument. I was even more surprised when it was scheduled for argument on bunk, indicating how important the issue in this case is, because in my view, the case has been decided by Fearley. And unless this court is in a position or intending to back away from that decision in Fearley, then this case has already been resolved.
Well, let me ask you this, and I don't know why I'm scheduled for argument either, but the chief, made the decision at the time. After reading Mr. Percival's argument, this is what concerns me, is the statute seems pretty clear in how it's worded. Fearley took a pretty expansive view of the statute on who it covers, you know, professional corporations, nurses, others. Would this now apply to chiropractors? Would it apply to veterinarians? I mean, where do you draw the line on this, on who's covered by the code and initiative and who isn't? And I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
As I read Fearley, Your Honor, it would apply to everybody who was included as a professional who could be sued for professional negligence in the healthcare practice. Everybody who's practicing in healthcare, it would include that. Fearley would include that.
Like a chiropractor.
Like a chiropractor. I mean, chiropractors especially practice in an area where you can't say they're not providing serious medical treatment. And they are certainly in a position, as the doctors were, at the time of the perceived problem in the state when the legislature enacted the requirements. And more importantly, at the time in 2004, when the initiative petition was filed, counsel's position, if you were to accept it, would be that for 5 years after the initiative petition was enacted, there was no requirement because this court didn't create that requirement until 2009. In fact, it says this court extended the statute, it expanded the statute. In his brief, he says that expanded the language of the statute, expanded the affidavit requirement, modified the initiative petition, amended the statute, and made new law. Justice Douglas hit the nail right on the head when he said, how do you get around the argument that this is not new law, it's just a construction of the statute? And unless it's new law, it applies retroactively. When an appellate court makes law, which is in the common law, that's generally in the common law tradition, if it's new law and it's not foreseeable law, That's generally not retroactive, but when an appellate court construes a statute, that's retroactive. If we were to accept the position that has been argued here, you would have to say that every time an appellate court reviews a statute for the first time, that statute can't be enforced prior to that time, regardless of how long it takes before the appellate court reviews that statute, because the court says, this is the first time I'm going to review the statute. The same would be true with an ambiguous statute. Counsel gave us a definition of ambiguous, and really, with all due respect, the entire defense is, I didn't read the statute correctly, and you should save me from this. I can find an ambiguity in any statute. Any lawyer can. Reasonable minds can differ, and unreasonable minds will always differ on what a statute means, but when the court construes a statute, and that's what happened in this case, generally speaking, it's a construction of the statute, and that
you didn't move to dismiss the complaint right out of the chute. I mean, the case went down its merry path, so the Fairley decision came out, and you also didn't raise it as an affirmative defense. It would suggest, at least to me, that you probably agreed with Mr. Percival when you filed your answer, that a lawyer as good as you would have come in and knocked it out immediately. You know, like,
I'm not sure that it was considered. There was some delay there, but the delay... after the Fairley case came out, then there was no doubt about what the law was, and we acted quickly. As far as talking about latches and the delay, counsel said, well, we were all involved in discovery and everything was going forward. And it was going forward very, very slowly. They didn't do a joint case conference report until after the 240 days were up, and we had to bring a motion to compel it. It's not like they were moving this along quickly. But to answer that question directly, Your Honor, we pleaded as an affirmative defense failure to state a claim. We didn't plead as an affirmative defense this because it's not an affirmative defense. Subject matter jurisdiction isn't an affirmative defense. I don't have to plead that the court doesn't have jurisdiction over the case as an affirmative defense. If you were to stretch the avoidance language of the rule that you have to plead anything that would be an avoidance, you would have to plead things that are simply matters of law. And it's not possible that the affidavit requirement is an affirmative defense. The reason it's not possible is because in Rational Med versus District Court, this court said that complaint is void ab initio. It cannot be amended, and it does not legally exist. No action can be taken unless this court is going to back away from that position, which I don't foresee that it's going to do. Then it's not an affirmative defense, and we didn't need to plead it. We didn't need to put them on notice, and the argument that had we put them on notice, they would have done the affidavit is disingenuous. Counsel believed that he didn't have to do an affidavit. If we put in our answer, you didn't do an affidavit, he wouldn't have gone out and amended his complaint and done an affidavit. He'd probably called up and said, I don't have to do an affidavit. There may have been some ambiguity in the statute. I'm not saying there was. In fact, in Fiore, this court said, there is ambiguity in the statute. But then this court considered the statute. It considered the legislative history. It construed the statute. That's what lawyers are supposed to do on behalf of their clients. That's what this court did. It didn't expand the law. It didn't apply it for the first time. It's not new law. This court simply construed a statute that by that time was 5 years old. To accept the argument that ruling in theory should not be retroactive would open the floodgates of litigation. I understand that there is some feeling that it was unfair to Ms. Egan. And I understand that she suffered a serious injury, and I'm not unsympathetic to that. But the law requires fairness to the doctors also, and the law requires that this is the way you start the action. And what's important here is counsel's admission over and over in the briefs and before this court today. I had that affidavit in my hand, and I made a decision not to attach it. It wasn't attached. That complaint was void. Can we tell Judge Walsh that
You read the Fearley decision incorrectly when you applied that law correctly when the motion was brought, and that was error. That's not what she did. She read the decision and she followed the decision, and that decision was simply a declaration of what the law was, what the people did during that initiative. There's nothing in that opinion that can be read as, we think that this should be applied in the future, or we think these people should be protected as a matter of common law. It was an analysis of what the people did and what the legislature and the people intended. That's exactly, it wasn't like Miranda. We didn't make up a new warning that you have to give to everybody. It was simply like 100, 200, 300 cases that this court does a year. A statute needs to be construed. We say what it means, and then we apply it. In this case, we said what it meant in Fearley, and we applied it in Fearley to the people in Fearley. There's no indication that it wouldn't apply there, and there is no way that you can distinguish this case from Fearley. It's exactly the same. We have a person who is sued for professional negligence, not medical malpractice, and there's no affidavit that is filed. And so the only argument is, should there have been an affidavit? And the answer is there should have been an affidavit. It's a bright line test. As this court said, it cuts with a sharp but a clean edge. If you were to decide not to do this, in the brief, counsel argued, there's the purpose of the statute has been satisfied. I have my affidavit. This isn't a frivolous suit. The purpose of the statute was so that there wouldn't be frivolous medical malpractice suits, and that's been satisfied. So you should find a way to make an exception for me to apply to the rule, to have to be subject to the rule. As soon as you make an exception, you throw the rule out the window.
Even if we find tolling of the statute of limitations in this rule?
Even if you were to find tolling of the statute of limitations. Because this isn't about the statute of limitations. The dismissal is mandatory. And the only basis for finding a tolling of that statute of limitations in this case would be if you found that something that we did, that the defense did, wasn't me. Something that the defense did that would warrant tolling the statute of limitations, hid the facts, did something underhanded. Unless we were required to declare this to the other side, there's no basis for tolling the statute of limitations. But even if you did toll the statute of limitations, you would have to come up with a standard upon which you would toll that statute of limitations, and it would be a discretion standard. And that would mean in every single case where the date was missed, counsel in district court will bring the argument, this is a case where the statute should be told, and here's the reason why. And then the district court has to review that, and the district court has to decide that as a matter of discretion. And if the district court grants it, it comes up here on an appeal, and this court has to decide whether the district court abused its discretion. And if the district court denies it, it comes up here on a petition for a writ, on a claim that the district court has manifestly abused discretion. As soon as you break the bright line of the bright line test, you've defeated the purpose. Now, I understand there are lots of things in the law where we don't make bright line tests, where it makes a lot of sense for the common law to decide on a case-by-case basis, and different facts make a strong difference on whether or not, as a matter of policy, this particular case should go forward or shouldn't go forward, but not on this procedural rule. This is a procedural rule. It cuts with a sharp and a clean edge, and with that sharp and clean edge, there will not be unnecessary litigation, and that's exactly what's being he's asking this court to do here. On the constitutional issue, counsel says that Fearley rendered the statute vague. That's not a constitutional standard I've ever heard of, that a court case can render a statute facially vague. In the briefs, it's a facial challenge to the constitutionality of the statute. That's what's raised in the briefs. Number one, never raised below. Not even close. The fact that he argued that it wasn't fair doesn't mean he raised a vagueness challenge to the statute on its face. That was never done. recognizing that this court could reach a constitutional issue, certainly could do so within its discretion. This court shouldn't do so here. There was no record created on that. But beyond that, the ambiguity that he thinks is there that creates vagueness, he says, is on a facial challenge, makes the statute unconstitutional, which would require striking it. But he argues, not a facial challenge, he argues an as-applied argument. He says, as applied to my case, because I didn't follow the statute, I lost my case, and therefore it's unfair because it was vague, because I didn't read the statute right. And I went out and I talked to some other friends, and I'm not disrespectful or denigrating that opinion in any way. This court had to struggle with that opinion in the Fairleigh decision. But the fact of the matter is, the statute isn't vague. It was ambiguous, and it was construed for the first time. And every time a statute is ambiguous doesn't mean that that when this court construes it for the first time or the tenth time, that construction of the statute should not be applied retroactively. If you accept that argument, there's no stability in the law. No statute can be enforced. No ruling of the court is final. Because later on, the statute could be changed, the statute could be construed, the court could change the statute or its view of the statute somewhat. And in the interim time, the argument would always be, there wasn't any law because this court hadn't construed the statute. That's not what the retroactivity doctrine is about. Retroactivity, when the court's decision is not retroactive, that is reserved for those cases where the court has really made law that couldn't be foreseen. That's the case law that's cited for the first time in the reply brief. It has to be new law, and it has to have not been foreseeable. This is not new law. We've gone through that. And it certainly was foreseeable. In fact, this court warned in the Washington case, this court warned counsel, said, the prudent thing to do, file an affidavit in every case. It wasn't done in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. First of all, I'll give you a minute in rebuttal.
Judge, with respect to the vagueness, I mean, the court, what the due process clause requires is that a party be given adequate notice of what is required of him to comply. The statute specifically says that you have to file an affidavit in cases of medical malpractice. This case does not fit the statutory definition of medical malpractice, which is what we were told by 41A.013 and 41A.009. Therefore, when the reader, a man of ordinary intelligence, reads that statute, he's not placed on notice that it's going to be applicable to someone other than the physicians, surgeons, and hospitals, employees of hospitals that the statute specifically delineates. And therefore, it fails because it fails to give notice to take the plaintiff's right to sue away when she wasn't adequately apprised of that requirement violates due process. And that's why, I'm not trying to weasel out of something, that's why this new decision created new law and should not be applied retroactively to the cases that were filed before it.
Thank you, Mr. Percival. Thank you, Mr. Wall. The court thanks both of you for your arguments and briefs in this matter, and this matter will stand submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.